NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Attorney General William Barr on the hot seat this week with revelations of behind-the-scenes tension with Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. Barr dismissed the weight of Mueller's objections to Barr's public statements with this memorable slap.
The letter's a bit snitty, and I think it was probably written by one of his staff people.
Yesterday, Barr refused to appear before the House Judiciary Committee, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made a stark charge about Barr's testimony to the House in April, given those revelations.
He lied to Congress. He lied to Congress. If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime.
And this week, two deadly shootings, one in a California synagogue, the other on a North Carolina college campus. That state's governor, Roy Cooper, spoke to support the victims of Tuesday's shooting in Charlotte.
We know that for many people here, this will be the worst day of their lives. So we want to be here for them.
Join us. What do you make of the Attorney General's performance? What questions do you have about the tensions between Barr and Mueller? What do you want Congress to do about that report? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us from Washington, D.C. is Molly Ball. She's national political correspondent for Time magazine. Molly, thanks for being with us once more.
Great to be here.
Also with us from Washington, Eugene Scott. He's a politics reporter for The Washington Post. Eugene, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And to complete the trifecta, from Washington, D.C., we have Sadie Gurman of The Wall Street Journal, where she covers the Justice Department. Sadie, welcome to you, too.
Thanks, David.
I want to note On Point news analyst Jack Beatty has the day off. Sadie, let's start with you. Let's take a moment and think about what we've learned just this week. Reports out of a letter from the special prosecutor, Bob Mueller, in which he wrote, I want to quote from this. It turned out this letter was written on March 27th. The summary letter the department sent to Congress and released to the public in the late in the afternoon of March 24th, this is by the Attorney General, did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office's work and conclusions. He said he communicated to the department that concern on the morning of March 25th and continues, there is now public confusion about critical aspects of the results of our investigation. On Wednesday, Attorney General William Barr appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee and he defended his public interpretation of the Mueller report this way.
After a months-long trial, if I wanted to go out and get out to the public what the verdict was, pending preparation of the full transcript, and the prosecutor comes up and taps me on the shoulder and says, well, the verdict doesn't really fully capture all my work. How about that great, cross-examination I did, or how about that third day of trial where I did that? This doesn't capture everything. My answer to that is I'm not trying to capture everything. I'm just trying to state the verdict.
Sadie Gurman, how meaningful is this?
Well, I think it's very meaningful. I mean, it was an explosive week for the Justice Department. We really got our fullest and clearest picture yet of a rift between Barr and Mueller, which is significant. And not only is, Mueller criticizing the way that Barr unrolled his findings, but Barr is also criticizing Mueller's, inability to come to a conclusion as to whether the president obstructed justice. So in a sense, they're both – these are longtime colleagues and apparently friends, and they're being openly critical of each other in this setting. I think it's very consequential.
Can you think of anything quite like this in terms of – Bob Mueller, as long as he's special prosecutor, is a senior Justice Department figure, right? It seems as though this is not only an explosive week as your Justice Department, but the sign of a real clash internally within it.
Yes, that's right. I think that, it's actually very remarkable that Mueller would put his thoughts into writing as opposed to, as Barr suggested, calling him and saying, hey, I'm not happy with the way that you are representing my findings. So I think it's very significant that Mueller actually chose to write this down for the record.
This week, obviously there were the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings. Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois and a senior one at that, really explored with Barr the question of the fact that Mueller put this in writing. Here's how their exchange went.
I talked directly to Bob, and Bob told me that he did not have objections to the accuracy.
Attorneys don't put things in writing unless they're pretty serious about them.
Molly Ball, what did you make of how Senate Democrats approached the revelations and approached the hearings that we saw play out this Wednesday?
Well, you heard some real anger from the Senate Democrats. Particularly, there's a feeling that Barr misrepresented himself in his confirmation hearings. A lot of this stuff came up in Bill Barr's confirmation hearings earlier this year. The Democrats on the committee pressing him on his impartiality, his respect for the rule of law, all of these things that, you know, the president's opponents worry are being compromised. And they now feel that he has become a partisan advocate for the president rather than the impartial figure that he presented himself as when he was being confirmed with some Democratic votes. So I think you heard not only the Democrats feeling strongly about the Mueller report and its contents and Barr's alleged misrepresentation of it, but also feeling a little bit burned, feeling betrayed by an attorney general who wasn't what some of them hoped he would be.
Eugene Scott, there was a line in Barr's testimony that really jumped out at me as Democrats were grilling him about how the attorney general condensed the special prosecutor's 400-page report into what was initially a 4-page synopsis. And in his testimony, the attorney general made clear he felt he could do with it what he wanted.
His work concluded when he sent his report to the attorney general. At that point, it was my baby.
Gene Scott, William Barr was and is the attorney general of the United States. Is he wrong on that? Isn't it his baby?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Obviously, that is what he believes, as does the president of the United States. But this being his baby was, quite frankly, the Democratic lawmakers' biggest fear, that the president was going to hire an attorney who would be more interested in serving him than the American people. Quite frankly, the next Michael Cohen, in so many words. And so I think that's what you're seeing some lawmakers push back on currently, suggesting that they could possibly hold him in contempt in the future, and some conversations even about sending him a subpoena so that he can actually testify about what it is that he did, because there is not, I guess we should say, overall conclusion that this, in fact, is his baby and which would allow him to make the decisions that he thinks he had the right to make.
You know, Gene Scott, there we have a commentator and website who's echoing what you're saying about Michael Cohen, the president's former personal attorney, who said he would take a bullet for the president until, I guess, he turned state's evidence on him. The listener on our website says Barr keeps saying things a defense attorney would say. Among those who said give Bill Barr a chance was Benjamin Wittes. He's the editor-in-chief of Lawfare, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And he had basically written when Barr was announced, look, give Bill Barr a chance. He was attorney general before, distinguished figure of the Republican establishment, legal establishment. This could be possibly in some ways the best honest broker that the Justice Department could get in this time. He now writes, and this quote from a story or a posting he made in The Atlantic magazine just last night, he wrote, "It has been catastrophic. Not in my memory has a sitting attorney general more diminished the credibility of his department on any subject. It is a kind of trope of political opposition in every administration that the attorney general, whoever he or she is politicizing the Justice Department and acting as a defense attorney for the president. In this case, it is true. Where Barr has utterly failed, he continues, is in providing honest leadership that insulates the department from the predations of the president. I confess I'm surprised by this. I've never known Barr well, but I thought better of him than that." Sadie Gurman, you've covered the Justice Department for some time. What is the assessment of Barr by sort of nonpartisan or non-ideological figures who are examining how he's playing in this moment of crisis for the administration?
Well, I think, you know, that many people feel like we shouldn't be terribly surprised by the way Barr is handling this. He is somebody who has long been an advocate for sweeping executive power. This is what we saw from him when he was attorney general under the George H.W. Bush administration. And this is something that he sort of prepared us for back in December when we learned that he had actually written a 19-page memo to Justice Department leaders in June as a private citizen criticizing certain aspects of the Mueller investigation. And he, you know, he took his his free time to do this and made it known how he has made his views known. So I think people in the legal community are actually not terribly surprised by this, knowing where he stands on these issues of executive authority.
Want to take a quick call or two before our break of the first segment. Tom is calling from Camden, Maine. Tom, go ahead.
Thanks. Hello.
Tom, go ahead, please. You're on
I just wanted to make a point that I wonder how differently if everyone, maybe Democrats, would react if Barr's conclusion was to their liking. It seems like he's being attacked as a messenger. I admit that he looks like a liar, frankly. That's an appearance thing, but that's because he's a fat Democrat with goofy glasses. But fat Republican. So my point is that let's talk about that. Everyone's attacking everything from the Democratic liberal side. I'm an independent, so it doesn't matter. But somebody, please, you started to talk about a nonpartisan response, but you had Molly talking about it. Have someone who is nonpartisan talk about the reaction to Barr, okay?
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Tom. Appreciate it.
I would just like to interject that I am not a partisan. I am a reporter. I'm not a commentator or a liberal or a conservative.
I think that's fair, Molly. It's reporting for Time Magazine.
Can I push back?
Yes, Gene Scott, please, briefly.
The issue is that Barr is not a messenger. That's why Mueller wrote the report. Barr's summary is not identical, even close, to the Mueller report. He's not a messenger.
And so in that case, not being an honest broker in that instance, as Democrats say, but as also a lot of journalists are saying in their analysis of this. We're talking about the week's news. We want all of you to stick around. We're going to have our guest reporters stick around. You can join our conversation. What do you think of Barr's performance? How would you like Congress to handle the Mueller findings? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the week's top headlines. You can join our conversation. What do you think of Barr's performance? How would you like Congress to handle the Mueller findings? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today, Molly Ball of Time Magazine, Eugene Scott of The Washington Post, and Sadie Gurman of The Wall Street Journal. Well, first, I'd actually like to go to the phones one more time. I want to take a call from Englewood, Colorado. Esther, go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, Nancy Pelosi said that if anyone else were to lie to Congress, it would be considered a crime. I'm wondering why, if the AG committed a crime or lied to Congress, it is not considered a crime. And if it is a crime, then what are the possible consequences?
Okay, Esther, I'm going to toss that to our expert, Sadie Gurman. You cover the Justice Department. You know most things legal. Tell us why, in this instance, Nancy Pelosi might be saying if it were anyone else, it would be a lie.
Well, first of all, I should point out that this caller is my mom. Calling from Englewood, Colorado, where I'm from. So, hi, Mom. She could have easily asked me this over dinner.
What we like to say is we like to have a national conversation. At times, apparently, we also like to have family conversations. So, welcome, Sadie. Welcome, Esther. Go ahead. So, actually, there's a question there. Sure.
She does raise a good point. I think the point that Pelosi was trying to make was more just that, you know, we're failing to hold that, you know, Barr needs to be held accountable in her vantage point. That, you know, if somebody else lied to Congress, the standards for holding him accountable would be less. This is just the point that she's making. I think it's less of a legal point and more of a political point, really, you know, that, you know, if a layperson came before Congress and lied, they would be charged with a crime. So I think that's the point she's making, and I do appreciate the question.
And also, can we say the journalistic disclosure and transparency, even in matters familial? We thank you for that as well. Molly Ball, we've been talking a little bit about the tension between Mueller and Barr this hour. I want to talk about the actually in some ways the thing that is springboarded by this question, which is the nature of the tension, it seems to me, between Barr and Congress. That is, it seemed as though he was very dismissive, both tonally and substantively, with the questions being posed by a lot of the Democratic senators, both through sort of reiteration of things or parsing hairs, but also seemingly, in my mind, kind of casting doubt on whether or not Congress deserves to get what it asks for.
That's right. And that reflects, I think, the pose of the entire administration when it comes to congressional oversight. Congress does have oversight responsibilities over the executive branch, and they have asserted that by requesting a lot of information, requesting witnesses to testify from the administration, requesting the president's tax returns, which says very clearly in the law that the Congress may ask the IRS to provide people's tax returns to it, although the administration is making the case that doesn't apply to the president. But in all of these cases, rather than evaluate on a case-by-case basis and have the administration say, as previous administrations have, okay, this we will give you, this we will give you, let's meet in the middle, here's who you can talk to, this we don't think is appropriate, this we think is going too far. They haven't done any of that. They've just said, boom, no. No to everything. It's a stonewall. It's nobody is going to testify if we can possibly keep them. We're not going to provide you with any of this information. And so it's all going to wind up in court, either because they actually believe that none of this information is legitimately sought by Congress, or because they're just seeking to drag out the process for as long as possible and to make it more difficult for Congress to do its job, at least as the Congress sees it. Either way, the result is going to be that a lot of these voluntary requests for information are going to have to turn into subpoenas, and then a lot of the administration's refusal of subpoenas is going to end up in court.
Gene Scott, the Attorney General yesterday refused to appear before the House Judiciary Committee. Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler, who's a New York Democrat, said Barr simply has to answer to Congress.
If he does not provide this committee with the information it demands and the respect it deserves, Mr. Barr's moment of accountability will come soon enough.
You know, at times I discourage people from echoes of Watergate because I think it leads people to think that somehow this story heads down the same path. And I think we heard a lot of recrimination of those pundits who stressed Watergate all the time when we saw what the findings of the Mueller report were and were not. At the same time, this confrontation with Congress seems real. Although there are those who point out, hey, look, President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder was held in contempt of Congress over investigations into the Fast and Furious debacle with the, I believe it was the ATF. How high stakes is this? How important is this standoff as it's shaping up at the moment?
Well, I think it's quite significant when it comes to power in our country. I think one of the main criticisms that Congress has had of Trump and Congress before this administration had of Obama is not feeling like an equal branch of government and not feeling respected by the executive not having individuals the answer to the executive comply with requests and concerns of the lawmakers that represent the American public. And so I think that's a narrative we're going to continue to see Democratic lawmakers promote as we head into 2020, what the White House will do to communicate to Americans that the positions that they are taking and their, Trump aides are taking is in the best interest of the American people and not just the president himself will be really interesting to pay attention to and quite frankly will be important to see how voters respond to it.
I'd like to take a call now from New Philadelphia, Ohio. Jeff, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just calling in. I was listening on the radio. Mm-hmm. I want to preface this that I didn't vote for Donald Trump. But what Mueller did was his job. What the AG did, Barr, was his job. And half the country's not happy with it. Mm-hmm. After watching for about 2 years, we got a big problem there long before Donald Trump was there.
Jeff, before I let you go, and I appreciate very much your observation, may I ask you a quick question, which is that you said Mueller did his job, and you respected him for it. You said the attorney general did his job. If the special prosecutor Mueller has said that actually the attorney general presented his findings essentially deceptively, which is what he wrote in that letter. He said he didn't capture the substance, context, or nature of his conclusions. Does that affect how you feel about how the attorney general is performing his job?
If Mueller had thought that Donald Trump should have been indicted for something, he would have said that. He couldn't and didn't find anything, so he gave his report to the AG, Barr. Barr looked at it with much better eyes than you and I can and had to make a decision. He didn't think there was anything to legally go after, and he put it to rest.
I appreciate that, Jeff. Thank you so much for your call. Thanks so much. Sadie Gurman, just take a moment and parse that for us. It seemed as though the attorney general – I don't want to go back too much on Mueller, but nonetheless, the attorney general in presenting Mueller's findings as we now know it from Mueller's take on the presentation essentially took – he did not find evidence to present an indictment as an exoneration that there was no evidence of something. How scrupulously did the attorney general ultimately present Mueller's findings?
Well, I think he presented Mueller's findings as he saw them, which obviously and he's saying, you know, you can read the report for yourself and make your own conclusions about it. But Mueller laid out 10 episodes of possible obstruction of justice. And the way that, you know, the attorney general is interpreting those is mostly that, you know, the president, this was, you know, not criminal behavior. This was the president, you know, voicing his frustration or acting out of frustration over being investigated. And so he, you know, I think has a different take on what the significance is of some of these episodes than Mueller did. But according to Barr, you know, he carefully studied the report before, you know, making his analysis. I think that's something Democrats in particular would argue with. But he's saying, look, you know, the report is out. I put it out there. I'm being transparent. You decide for yourself. There's an election in 18 months. The Justice Department's role in this is over.
So let's to that point, let's play a couple of quick clips here. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, interceded during the hearings Wednesday as the Hawaii Democratic Senator Mazie Hirono grilled Barr, and it set up this intense exchange.
Please, Mr. Attorney General, you know, give us some credit for knowing what the hell is going on around here with you.
Not really. To this line of questioning.
So,
listen, you've slandered this man.
Yeah, what I sort of want to know is how do we get to this point? Yeah,
I do not think that I'm slandering anyone.
Mr.
Chairman, I am done. Thank you very much.
And you slandered this man from top to bottom.
During his testimony, Barr also said the investigation had been politicized by his critics and those of the president.
Everyone can decide for themselves. There's an election in 18 months. That's a very democratic process. But we're out of it. And we have to stop using the criminal justice process as a political weapon.
So, Eugene Scott, to what degree has this become a purely political endeavor? And a purely partisan endeavor as opposed to one where political figures are trying to figure out how best to move forward and what the truth may actually be?
Well, that obviously depends on the politics and the perspective and worldview of the individual asking the question. Trump believes that it's purely partisan, as do his supporters and even right-leaning independents, as we've heard even with some of the callers, really do think that the questions and the pushback from Democratic lawmakers and activists think this is solely partisan. But when I talk to voters on the ground, I meet a lot of people who really are concerned about the relationship between our electoral process and interference, not just from Russia in 2016, but moving forward from Russia and perhaps other foreign governments. And so the desire to get to the bottom of what happened and what could happen in the future is a concern for many voters outside of their disgust or approval of President Trump.
Eugene, you find that even though, for example, we have a comment from Twitter from one listener under the handle Flatbroke, who writes, "Action speaks louder than words. For 2 years swaying the lower chamber of Congress with majority power, Democrats could do a whole lot more than just investigate, you know, the Mueller report." You do see in polls that people are citing other concerns as being primary, but you're saying you find actual voters coming up to you and saying, you know what, this actually matters to me. I'm thinking about fundamental questions about the nature of the balance of power between branches of government and accountability in government.
Well, two things. Yes. Yes, this is a very valid concern from voters I speak with. This is the primary concern as they head into 2020. No. But there are questions, one, about whether or not there are equal branches of government and that the president is not going to be able to carry out some of his natural authoritarian impulses, which we actually saw in the Mueller report, and that democracy will be what it is designed to be. That is a very valid concern from people I speak with on the ground. Secondly, one of the reasons there is concern is we do know that despite there being record participation in the 2016 presidential election and even the 2018 midterms, there is low confidence among many Americans, specifically from marginalized groups, that their vote will even matter, that their voices will be heard. And so if there is this perception that interference can happen to the degree that what they do doesn't register, they may want to sit out or disengage.
Molly Ball, you know, while Democrats focused on questioning the attorney general about his conclusions, Republicans often concentrated on different and familiar themes. Hillary Clinton's emails, claims the Trump campaign was spied on, and allegations of past bias by the Justice Department. Here's Texas Senator John Cornyn, a Republican.
We now need to know what steps the Obama FBI, Department of Justice, and intelligence community, what steps they took to undermine the political process and put a thumb on the scale in favor of one political candidate over the other.
So, Molly, what's the state of play and the seriousness of the look into how the FBI and investigators looked at the Trump campaign and the Trump world in terms of the dealings that were under review?
Well, from the very beginning of his administration, President Trump has sought to depict this investigation as a witch hunt. And he's talked about being spied upon by the Obama administration, the FBI, under former Director Jim Comey. There's a story in the New York Times this morning that, in fact, an FBI agent posing as a researcher interacted with a Trump campaign official. And Republicans and the administration are saying this validates the president and the attorney general's claims of spying and that this was improper. The intelligence community saying, well, it is a matter of course they investigate things like what the Russians are doing and whether the Russians are trying to meddle in American elections, and that was the purpose of that type of work. But I think there's a lot we still don't know, and it has been the perspective of the president's defenders that what needs to be investigated more than anything is the investigators and trying to turn this around to the witch hunt that the president has claimed.
Gene Scott, I wanted to turn just for a minute before our before we end the second segment of the show to Stephen Moore. He's the president made clear he intended to nominate him. Stephen Moore writes about economics. He has held positions at the Wall Street Journal and certain think tanks and in political realm. And that has been withdrawn before it even really got to launch. What happened to Stephen Moore, this second intended Fed nominee to be pulled by the president in recent weeks?
Well, one of the things that happened, in addition to significant criticism from people on both sides of the aisle, that despite his work with conservative think tanks and writing conservative pieces for media outlets, was that he just did actually not have the experience needed to be on the Federal Reserve Board. What actually caught most of the headlines, in addition to him lacking the expertise, is some of his past positions on women and gender roles and people of color, specifically Black Americans and some stereotypes. And he just exposed himself to have some worldviews that many Republican lawmakers found troublesome. Democrats obviously thought that he was more interested in just supporting the ideas and values of the president than serving the American people as a whole on the board.
We're discussing the news of the week with our Reporters Roundtable. You can join our conversation. We'll talk in a few moments about 2020. What do you think of Joe Biden on the trail? How about the latest entry, Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and we're talking about the big stories of the week. You can join the conversation. What do you think of the newest Democrats on the field? What about Facebook banning a bunch of extremists for spreading hate? Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today, Sadie Gurman of The Wall Street Journal, Molly Ball of Time Magazine, and Eugene Scott of The Washington Post. We, just to mention in passing, we are tracking developments in Venezuela, where there was an armed standoff at moments between the president who leads the country, Nicolas Maduro, and the self-declared president, Juan Guaido, who has the support of the Trump administration and many foreign governments after a disputed election there. I also wanted to briefly note one moment of political agreement in Washington this week. Congressional Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi sounded an optimistic note after meeting with President Trump over a $2 trillion infrastructure package. Here's Senator Schumer.
First, we agreed that infrastructure is crucial to the future of America. We agreed it creates jobs. We agreed it keeps us competitive. We agreed that for 25 years, this kind of a big, bold bill that we could pass would make America a better place. This is not just a 1 year or 2 year.
Molly Ball, give us the Sparks Notes version of this, you know, 30 seconds or so. Is this real?
It remains to be seen. Democrats were surprised at how positively this meeting went. President Trump campaigned on the idea of building a lot of new infrastructure. He is a builder by trade, and this is not traditionally the idea of spending a lot of federal money on infrastructure in particular has not been one that Republicans have embraced. However, for a long time, infrastructure was bipartisan. Every 5 years, they passed an infrastructure bill with lots of federal spending, building, you know, the highways and the roads and bridges across the country. That began to change under the Obama administration. There was an infrastructure bill passed in the final years, but it was a small one. Democrats went into this meeting to and apparently convinced the president that they want that they should spend a lot of federal money on this, but the devil will be in the details. And now it is on the White House to come up with some way to pay for this $2 trillion in federal spending. And they're going to meet again in a couple of weeks.
Speaking of the White House, let's turn to the 2020 race. Colorado Senator Michael Bennett became the 21st candidate, if my numbers are right, to jump into the presidential race on the Democratic side this week. He made his announcement on CBS this morning and cited two overarching goals.
One is a lack of economic mobility and opportunity for most Americans, and the other is the need to restore integrity to our government.
And to be fair, I think he's saying he wants to address the lack of economic mobility and opportunity for Americans. Eugene Scott, what can you tell us about to whom Bennett might appeal and what figure he might present in this race?
To be completely honest, this is a question I was trying to get answered yesterday, especially when you consider the 20 other individuals already running. Bennett, I think, at best believes that he understands parts of the country that are well represented by both conservatives and Democrats. Perhaps he believes he comes from a much more diverse part of the country and can really testify to working across lines and bringing groups together who normally do not collaborate to form answers or decisions, answers to their questions and make decisions to, you know, tough situations. But quite frankly, I'm not quite sure yet that he has communicated what he will bring to the table that voters still find lacking from the other candidates. In many ways, he is very similar to people already running.
Molly Ball, he strikes me, Michael Bennett, as in some ways what you might think of as a meritocrat, you know, or a technocrat, or somebody who's thinking pragmatically, I can come up with solutions. He's not seen as a highly partisan figure among Democrats or among this particular field. But there's a lot of folks who want a certain kind of passion. Peter Baker from the New York Times wrote a story saying that Joe Biden, the former vice president, was alternating between soaring rhetoric and kind of a jumble of allusions to various policies he's been interested in over the years. Bennett's not even the only Coloradan in the field this year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, like this panel, which has two Coloradans on it, myself and Sadie. There are two Coloradans among the major candidates, the other being former Governor John Hickenlooper. Bennett was seen as a centrist and a pragmatist for a long time. His background, not in politics, but as the superintendent of the Denver schools and something of an education reformer, which is not something that the left has necessarily been enthusiastic about. But he had this viral moment during the government shutdown in January where he took to the floor of the Senate and railed against what he called the crocodile tears of the Republicans. Mm-hmm. And this speech was very passionate, and it really took off. And it, was all over Twitter and so on. And so I think that was a moment where, number one, he tasted the glory of that kind of national recognition and maybe found that he might have more appeal than was previously thought. And number two, he has, I think, like a lot of Democrats, been not necessarily radicalized, but pushed by the Trump administration to becoming a little bit more of a partisan warrior because of what he sees as the terrible things the administration is doing. So, you know, there's the fact that there are so many Democrats in this presidential race, I think, shows you how unstable it is that although Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders appear to be rather stable co-front runners, the other Democrats really think there is a lot of room for someone else to break out and that the party may be looking for a fresher face, even if the voters don't know it yet. And secondly, that there's just no downside, that you might as well give it a shot and maybe it doesn't work out, but you've got as good a chance as anybody. So you might as well, like all of your colleagues basically in the Senate, just dip your toe in and see if it takes off.
Want to take a call or two on this. We have John from Berea, Ohio. John, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. May I still make a remark about the Mueller report, or is it too late?
Well, it's kind of like your thoughts here about the 2020 race. Let's focus on that.
Oh, the 2020 race?
Yes, sir.
Well, I think that Joe Biden would make a great president. In fact, I think he's the only one that would stand a chance against Trump. That's my opinion.
And why do you think that, John?
Well, he's got the experience and the personality to be the president. And as far as him touching women was concerned, it was not sexual.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate your thoughts on that, John. An endorsement from the Buckeye State for the former Vice President Biden. We also have a call from Columbia, Missouri. Ellen, go ahead, share your thoughts.
Yes, hi. I'm a Democrat, and I desperately want to see Trump voted out of office. But I also know that as long as Mitch McConnell is the Senate leader, there's very little chance of any of the Democrats policies going forward. And so I am wondering what the panel thinks about why so many people, Bennett included, who would be strong candidates for the Senate are, instead of running for Senate, throwing their hats into the already very crowded presidential ring.
Well, thanks for that, Ellen. Sadie Gurman, why don't I throw that to you a little bit? It strikes me that there have been concerns mounting for Democrats in terms of their ability to attract big name and strong challengers to Republican senators for the cycle coming up. What does the state of play look like to you?
Well, to me, I've been curious, honestly. I mean, not to take it back to the Mueller report, but I have been curious how much this, is going to play out as a talking point in some of these races. It sounds like when these candidates have been going out into the field, they've been discussing far different issues that matter to voters. So, I'm just, for my part, very curious to see, how that plays out in politics. But I think to your point, that's definitely a concern for the Democrats.
You think of Stacey Abrams in Georgia, who made such a national splash, even as she lost to now Governor Brian Kemp. She decided not to run for Senate, and she has aspirations that may play out differently.
Exactly.
I want to also take a moment to note the shootings that happened this week. A shooting in a synagogue outside San Diego, and also shooting at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, that we alluded to at the top of the show. Molly Ball, these things are all too common. In each instance, I believe there was somebody, at least as reports initially indicated, who stepped forward to try to either stop the shooter or who, in the case at the synagogue, who essentially took a bullet that otherwise would have hit the rabbi who had been there, people saving the lives of others. But it seems as though this is just a constant thrum and refrain. Is this being echoed in our politics? Are there ways in which this is actually being addressed more?
Yeah, I think it depends on what you mean by this, because you have two trends dovetailing here, right? One is what is seen as a rising tide of intolerance and hatred and extremist violence, whether it's white supremacists, anti-Semites, various forms of hatred leading people to commit mass murder, not only in the United States, but of course, notably at the mosque in New Zealand. And the other is what we've been dealing with for years in the United States, the epidemic of gun violence and the many school shootings and shootings at concerts and just mass shootings seeming to happen with alarming frequency. And you've seen in response to that a much more active and motivated movement for gun control than we have seen in many decades. And you now have the Democrats running very assertively on that issue that previously they shied away from for fear of alienating rural voters specifically. And meanwhile, there's infighting at the NRA, which has also weakened, I think, the anti-gun control side of that debate. So there's a couple of different trends that I think you can see in these disturbing incidents, and they're reflected in our politics, and some would say they are exacerbated by our politics.
Sadie Gurman, do you see anything at the Department of Justice that would address these things playing out under Attorney General Barr?
Well, Attorney General
Barr. Any new policy moves or, any initiatives being taken, that is, regardless of what form that might take?
Barr, like his predecessor before him, Jeff Sessions, has said that, making hate crimes, addressing hate crimes is a priority for him, but we haven't really seen that play out in a particular policy. It's been interesting to see what the rhetoric has been like and the reaction has been like from law enforcement and, the attorney general as it relates to these types of crimes. But, it's a stated priority. I just don't think that we have quite seen a policy rollout that directly addresses that.
And it's interesting also to note that that's looking at the hate crime part of it and not the question of guns, although there have been initiatives spun both the state and national level to at once make things more restrictive and in some ways make them more expansive in terms of gun ownership moves. I want to turn as final part of the show to Facebook, a presence in so many millions, tens of millions, of Americans' lives on a daily basis. Facebook took action yesterday and announced it was banning – call it a half dozen or so extremists, mostly on the political right, Eugene Scott, but not entirely. It included Alex Jones, of the founder of InfoWars, and it also included InfoWars and one of his deputies there, or somebody who had served as one of his editors there. The white nationalist or supremacist Paul Neelan, who had run against Paul Ryan for Congress in Wisconsin a few years back. It bounced Milo Yiannopoulos, the controversialist, and it also bounced the Nation of Islam leader, Louis Farrakhan. Eugene Scott, tell us why Facebook took these actions or said they did, and also what its stance has been to hate speech prior to now.
There has been increasing attention on Facebook and the role that it has played in allowing people with extremist views to not only use their platform to articulate their ideas, but to connect with other individuals who share equally as troublesome worldviews and to gather and to carry those out. And I think a few of the incidents that we've seen this year so far, social media and the internet have been cited as avenues for these individuals to create harm. A part of this being the latest continuation of ongoing conversations about the need to have some type of control and oversight of social media, I believe has led the individuals at Facebook to try to get out in front of what they fear could be coming from Congress in terms of how much freedom and control they have over their platform as a whole. What they have done previously, they've said, is just monitored activity from individuals on the extreme size of spectrums and removed a lot of their posts and prevented them from having a voice on Facebook. But I think in citing and targeting these very high profile individuals, names that many of us know, they want to send a message that no one is going to be above being deplatformed.
A comment from our website, the listener Evan W. posts, "I think social media platforms are finally making some correct decisions and taking some responsibility for their reach when it comes to banning controversial stories. There's a growing movement of dangerous white supremacy that continues to cause violence around the U.S. and around the world. The people who commit these acts of violence become radicalized by the internet, and social media only makes it easier to reach people with these ideas." You know, I cover media in my other job, and one of the things that I used to think that Facebook was just sort of trying to forestall regulation by saying that they do certain things and that they'd embrace certain kinds of government regulation. I have now come to the conclusion that they're desperate for the government to step in and set the rules of the road so they're no longer responsible for it, either legally or morally. We've been hearing from Eugene Scott, politics reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks, Eugene, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've also been hearing from Sadie Gurman, the Justice Department reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Glad you could join us.
Thank you.
And Molly Ball, she's national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Great to have you today, Molly Ball and Sadie Gurman, both learned colleagues from the state of Colorado. Thanks, Molly.
Thank you very much.
You continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on the Twitters and the Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producers, Karen Schiffman, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.